It is good to be with you this morning. Let's see. Tim and Doug and Alan and Debbie came back, and the Isons, the Gougers, and the Boyds, and some of the Davises left. I think you got the short end of the stick. And Tim can comment on that at the end of services if he likes. It's good to be back with you. I have to tell you, this last week, Debbie and I spent the week in Georgetown, Texas, just north of Austin. And we took a couple days, Friday and Saturday, to drive out there. Drove all the way back yesterday. It's about 13 hours driving time. So you can imagine my amazement when Sunday afternoon, we're meeting at 4 o'clock, and I guess it was 4:30, and in strides Doug Childs. And I'm thinking, what are you doing here? The brethren were immediately suspicious, wondering if the congregation here had sent a spy. It didn't help that I was preaching that evening in Genesis about Joseph accusing his brothers of being spies. And so I announced that the brethren here were probably determining whether I preached in poorly as Texas, in Texas as I do in Alabama. But Doug had been in at Fort Hood over the weekend, I guess, and worshipped there in Killeen in the morning and saw the meeting advertisement and so came. It was good to see him there, and it's good to see him here, but I really do admire his dedication. In the last week of our Savior's life upon this earth, Matthew in his gospel records that there was a lawyer who came and tested him. This is recorded in Matthew chapter 22, and he asked this question, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" And you probably remember that Jesus responded by citing the first and great commandment, "You shall love God with all that you are," and then noted that the second was like unto it, that you should love your neighbor as yourself, verse 39. And then he went on to comment, Jesus did, that on those two commandments, all in the law and the prophets hung. They served as the framework for the rest of the law and the prophets. And I would encourage you to note that in Romans the 13th chapter, the Apostle Paul made a similar statement. Jesus, of course, was speaking as a Jew who lived under the law of Moses. The lawyer who asked him this question was asking with reference to the law of Moses. What's the greatest commandment in the law of Moses was the context of the question. But now, in Romans the 13th chapter, we're dealing with the Apostle Paul under the new covenant, and he makes this comment in verse 8 and 9, 8 through 10 of Romans 13. "Owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet, if there's any other commandment, are all summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law." I really believe that he is talking about the law of Christ and not primarily the law of Moses. Paul was writing to Christians who lived under the new law, not the old law. And yet, he made the same observation that Jesus did about the commandment to love our neighbor. That basically it represents the fulfillment of the law. If we love our neighbor, we don't covet our neighbor's wife or commit adultery with her. We don't steal, we don't murder, etc. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus described how it is that kingdom citizens should love their neighbors in a variety of ways. I really believe that the latter part of chapter 5 from the Beatitudes, the end of the Beatitudes on, in Matthew 5, I believe that that has some of the most challenging instructions or obligations that you can find anywhere in the New Testament. And those passages, that passage in chapter 5 and even into chapter 6 and 7, deal with how we ought to treat one another. The love that Jesus calls us to exercise toward one another is a radical love by worldly standards. There are several passages or sections here in chapter 5, and I'm just going to talk about 5 this morning. Note those. Beginning in verse 21, Doug read for us from 17 to 20 of Matthew 5. But if you look in chapter 5 and verse 21, on down through verse 26, Jesus contrasts murder versus anger without a cause. Beginning in verse 27, he contrasts adultery versus lust in the heart. In verses 31 and 32, he contrasts the legal form of divorce versus causing one's divorce mate to commit adultery. In verse 37 and on down through verse, 33, on down through verse 37, he contrasts binding oaths versus total honesty. In verses 38 through 42, he contrasts just and fair punishment versus the right to personal vengeance. We'll say more about that in just a few moments. And then towards the end of the chapter, in verses 43 through 48, he contrasts love of neighbor, that one that we might willingly and easily love, versus love of all men, even the love of one's enemy. There seems to be a connection, a couple of different connections that bind these sections together. One of them has to do with the introduction to each of the six sections that I've listed, and we'll talk about that introduction in just a few moments. But the other is that, at least in a general way, all of these passages are joined together by addressing the same common theme, and that is, how do you show love toward others? In chapter 5, beginning in verse 17, the passage that Doug read for us just a few moments ago, Jesus talks about his attitude and his purpose with respect to the law of Moses. It's incredible to me that there are actually some who would suggest that what Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount, and particularly this portion of it, chapter 5, is that he's citing and actually attacking the superficiality of the law of Moses. That there's a viewpoint that actually has some popularity among brethren, that the contrast between the old law and the new law was that the old law was outward and physical, and the new law is inward and spiritual, and that they are very much on two different poles or extremes in that regard. And so they would suggest, people who hold this view would suggest, that the old law was primarily concerned with fleshly or outward matters, with ritual and appearance, etc., while the law of Christ addresses the heart of man. And I will just tell you, I think that is totally and completely wrong. Do not forget that when Jesus was asked the question in Matthew 22, the question that I referred to in the very beginning, "Teacher, what's the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus' response had to do with love. You should love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. He wasn't making up law. He was citing law. He was citing the Old Testament. Those were the greatest commandments, according to Jesus, of the Old Testament. The Old Testament didn't just deal with the outward, overt actions of man, but it dealt also with the heart of man. And I'll just be honest with you. It seems unlikely to me, in light of what Jesus says is his reverence for the law in this passage, that he would have engaged in some sort of withering attack against the requirements of the law. And so I reject the idea that Jesus is actually trying to show the superficiality of the law. You know, the law says this, but really what you need to do is more than that. If you'll notice the introduction to these sections, I've listed six sections, and today probably would have been a good day for charts. But I decided to sleep some last night instead of making charts. I hope you forgive me. But beginning in verse 21, it says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old." And then it seems very clear that Jesus does, in fact, cite the old law. Down in verse 27, the next section, the beginning of it, he says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery." And once again, Jesus cites the old law, although in the introduction, he talks about, "You have heard that it was said." In verse 31, he says, "Furthermore, it has been said." In verse 33, "Again, you have heard that it was said." And yet I don't know that Jesus is saying, okay, here's what people are saying about the law, because it seems very clear to me that he is citing the law, the very words of the law, in at least several of these cases. Well, what is Jesus trying to accomplish here? What's his point in bringing up the law in these various cases? I think the key is verse 20 of chapter 5. The very end of the reading that Doug did for us this morning. Jesus said, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." I want you to notice the position of that verse between Jesus' comments about his respect for the law. He says here in verse 17, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill." And he goes on to say that until heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. "Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven." Jesus is not depreciating the law of Moses in any way. He shows respect for it, indicating that his intention, his purpose is to fulfill that law. And then you have verse 20, where Jesus says, "You're going to have a righteousness that is superior to that of the Pharisees if, in fact, you will enter the kingdom of heaven." Immediately thereafter, he begins to cite the law, but he does so in a way that indicates he's paying attention to what others are saying about the law. "It has been said," and then he quotes the law, but I think we need to understand that Jesus is addressing the way that the Pharisees looked at the law, the traditions that they had built up, their interpretations of what the law permitted and forbid. I think Jesus is doing a couple of different things here, and I hope I can make this plain. This is a matter of some controversy among Bible students for a long, long time. Fortunately, I figured it out, and I'm going to share with you the answer here. Some of you looked up like, Let me tell you, I think he's doing two things. I think, first of all, and primarily, I believe Jesus is just describing what a citizen kingdom is like, a kingdom citizen is like, the character of those who will be part of the church or of the kingdom of Christ. But I think the way that he does that is to take the traditions of the elders and show how their understanding and application of the law was inadequate. It was faulty. And so with that kind of a statement, please understand that when Jesus says what he says in verse 20, that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll by no means enter the kingdom of heaven, that would have been shocking to the average Jew who considered the Pharisee essentially to be the paragon of righteousness. These were the guys who would only do business with other Pharisees sometimes. They wouldn't even buy and sell to people who were not Pharisees. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but there were several different classes of Pharisees. You could out-Pharisee other Pharisees, even, is the point. And, of course, the Pharisees wouldn't touch anybody who was unclean. They had to be constantly washing to make sure they weren't ritually unclean, and so forth. But what Jesus is going to do is he's going to say, listen, with all of their righteousness, they don't understand the law, the basic foundation principles of the law. The purpose of Jesus, I think, was to reveal the emptiness of Pharisaical righteousness and to lay out the moral principles of his kingdom. Now, he does that by citing laws from the Old Testament that dealt with how man was to behave in moral ways. Now, I'm going to point out just one example of something. In verse 31, Jesus talks about divorce. "Furthermore, it has been said," he says, "whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. Some have argued that all Jesus is doing here is just repeating the old law. And I would point out to you that particularly in that passage, it's very clear that he goes beyond what the old law said. He's not teaching the same thing that the old law taught about divorce and remarriage. He is providing a law which will be more strict than what was permitted by the old law. I want you to listen carefully to what I'm going to say next, because it's key. The moral principles, the foundation of the old law, were not really any different than the moral foundation of the law of Christ. I think sometimes we have this idea that the old law was given and it had its moral principles and regulations and everything. And what God did was He totally wiped that out. He started fresh and He delivered a law which was entirely different from that first law. And that's not really accurate. The moral foundation, call it the Decalogue if you will, although it would involve other things, the moral foundation of the law of Moses didn't really change when God instituted the new covenant. Many of those same moral principles are exactly the same. Let me illustrate it this way. Many of you are probably aware of this. I'm not sure how long it took me to figure it out, but you can look at two different cars that are, you know, kind of the same basic size and shape and everything, and yet they look very different. The body shape is different, and they have different little features and accessories and stuff. And yet, both of those cars have exactly the same chassis. Because automakers don't start fresh with every new model of car. They'll take a chassis that's basically designed for a certain weight or width and length of a car, and they'll use that same chassis for other cars. They just put a different body on the same chassis. And what I'm saying to you is that in somewhat the same way, what you've got is a chassis, you've got a moral foundation, a framework of moral principles that had to do with that constituted that foundation for the law of Moses. The new law works off of the same foundation. Now, let me say this. The old law was taken out of the way. The chassis is the same, it's just been repeated in the new law. Did that make sense? Is that clear? We're not living under any portion of the old law. But when you look at the moral foundation of the new law, it's not really radically different than what you were looking at under the old law. The same principles are true. And that's why in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus could talk about the old law and what it really meant when it said an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And yet still be talking about principles that relate to you and me as kingdom citizens. Hopefully that made sense. Now, what I would like to do is move to this first section in chapter 5, verses 21 through 26, and we'll spend the rest of our time this morning, the other 2 or 3 minutes, talking about this particular section. But let's read it together, beginning in verse 21. Jesus says, "You've heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment.' But I say to you, that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, 'Raca,' shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Agree with your adversary quickly while you are on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge hand you over to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you'll by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny." Now, Jesus' statement in the beginning of this passage in verse 21 seems, at least to me, to be an exact citation of the old law. We could look at it from Exodus chapter 20, even Numbers 35, but the successive verses, the following verses, reveal that Jesus is speaking to the Pharisaical preoccupation with crimes that could bring judgment of the local court or the council, but not address the condition of a person's heart. In other words, the Pharisees were very concerned with the outward actions, but not so concerned about the heart of man. It's easier to see those things that are outward. Obviously, we cannot see the condition of a man's heart with the same kind of clarity. The Pharisees had very little problem with anger or hatred as long as you didn't commit the sin of the overt act of violence. As long as you didn't murder. And of course you had to be careful about saying things for which there was punishment. Whether you're talking about the word raka, it's just a word that means empty. The concept is, I'm saying that you're a moron. You don't have anything upstairs, okay? I just gave some of the kids a new word. Don't use that. Remember the context here, okay? And of course, the word fool has the connotation frequently in the Scriptures of not just being someone who's not very wise, but someone who is godless, who is a moral reprobate. And so the Pharisees said, listen, you shouldn't murder. And Jesus says, listen, I'm going to go beyond that. You don't even speak in these ways to brothers. And you need to be careful about anger in your heart. Pharisees weren't worried about that. In John's first general epistle in chapter 3 and verse 15, he makes this observation, that if you hate your brother, you are a murderer. That's the point that Jesus is making here, that the way we think in our heart is significant in addition to how we behave in an outward fashion. Okay, I didn't lay any hands on my brother, but I sure wanted to. I didn't kill him, but I hated him in my heart. And John says, there really isn't any difference. In both cases, you're guilty of sin. That's the point, I think. How often do individuals harbor anger or hateful thoughts in their hearts, but they excuse themselves because they didn't openly strike their neighbor? You know, I didn't say anything wrong to my brother, even though in my heart I hate him for what he's done, or I'm angry without a cause because of something that I perceive to be a slight against me. Do we commit the same mistake as the Pharisees, thinking that only the outward actions of the body count? Now, Jesus gives an illustration, he says here in verse 23, an application. He says, therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, what are you supposed to do? So here you are, you're on your way to worship. That's the concept of bringing a gift to the altar. You're on your way to worship, and you realize that there's a problem between you and your brother. And Jesus says, listen, what you need to do is leave your gift. You go take care of this matter of being reconciled to your brother and then come back and offer your worship. You know, that'd be comparable to us gathering together and in an assembly like we have this morning, and we're just about ready to begin the assembly, or perhaps we're already in the midst of some of our worship activities, and suddenly a brother stands up and he just walks out of the auditorium. And he goes off someplace, and we don't see him, perhaps until the end of the assembly when he comes back in. And we said, well, no, that's kind of strange. Jesus said, before you worship me, take care of that matter. Now, I want you to understand, Jesus is not saying, listen, worship is not really all that important. There are other things more important. What he's saying is that your worship to God is affected by the way you treat others, by the way you treat your brother. I found out just recently in talking to some old friends that people that I love, that I've worked with in the past, they're separated by differences, disagreements, to the point where they can't even talk to each other. I'm talking about Christians. And yet, they're going to church, at least some of them are. They're going to church. They're worshiping. And I would say to you that based on what Jesus says here, they're wasting their time. What they need to do is reconcile their differences first before they decide they're going to try to worship God. Is that not what Jesus is saying in Matthew 5? I believe that it is. The importance of dealing with sin is emphasized by this business of leaving your gift and going and taking care of this matter with the brother. And I really believe that's what he's doing in verses 25 through 26. He just uses an illustration that focuses on the civil court. But the urgency of reconciling with one's brother seems to be the point in both of these illustrations. Well, what we've seen in our discussion of the Sermon on the Mount here, at least this particular section, is that Jesus seems to be exposing the emptiness of the righteousness of the Pharisees, at the same time that he appears to be explaining the true meaning of the old law, emphasizing that the law dealt with the heart of man. And in so doing, I believe he was also setting forth the ethical principles of his kingdom as well. Now, there's no question but that the Bible teaches that all of the things that we do, the things that are done in the body, Paul writes in 2 Corinthians, that we're going to be judged by all of those things. Our outward actions are important, but we need to be careful that we don't excuse ourselves by saying, I'm going to take care of the overt actions, and I'm not going to do anything that I shouldn't hear, but I'm going to excuse myself while I am angry with my brother and I'm hateful or lustful, and we'll talk about some of these other "it has been said" sections in successive studies. Even those things can cause us to be lost. Can I take one thought from what Jesus says here and use it to suggest that there may be somebody here this morning who needs to obey the gospel now? What Jesus said is, it's urgent that you take care of this business of reconciling with your brother. And I would say to you that if you've not obeyed the gospel, that if you're living in sin, you've never become a Christian, it is absolutely urgent that you be reconciled with your spiritual father, with God. And the plan of salvation that is presented in the New Testament says that we need to believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God. He's the only way to salvation. He's the only way to the Father. No one comes to the Father except through Him. And so in the figure of Matthew 5, verse 23 and 24, where you leave your gift at the altar, then what we ought to do is drop everything else. There's nothing else more important than the condition of your soul, whether you are forgiven of your sins and a child of God, or whether you stand in peril of eternal condemnation because you're separated from God. Have you obeyed the gospel? Have you expressed your faith in Jesus as the Christ, the Son of God? Having repented of your sins, have you been baptized into Christ? There are lots of people out in the world who consider themselves Christians because they do believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, but they haven't done what Jesus commanded through His apostles. Haven't been baptized into Christ, into His death for the remission of their sins. Have you? If you haven't, we want to encourage you. We stand to assist you even as you come to the front.